Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
As happens at the end of every big summit, the leaders of North and South Korea issued a joint statement after their meeting today. The deal on the North's nuclear program got all the headlines, but we read down a little bit farther and made a note of this. Almost everything else the two sides agreed on was about money. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com. And by Bank of America, believing that healthy communities and a healthy planet are essential to creating opportunities for everyone. Bank of America, Bank of Opportunity.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's great to have you with us today. It's Thursday, October the 4th. South Korea has plenty of money. The International Monetary Fund says it's the 12th largest economy in the world. North Korea, on the other hand, is far on the opposite end of that list, which speaks volumes about why so much of the negotiating this week has been financial. Marketplace's Elisa Roth has more.
The promises of economic cooperation include joint fishing grounds, the expansion of an industrial park, and reinstating freight train service between the two countries. South Korea will foot the bill, estimated to be in the billions of dollars. The benefits for the North, whose closed economy is practically non-existent, are clear. But for the South, the biggest draw may be political.
Well, stability is a lot.
William Overholt directs the RAND Corporation Center for Asia-Pacific Policy. He says the region's been a conflict zone for more than half a century, so the promise of peace might be worth a couple of billion.
Just to keep the momentum of the U.S.-Chinese-North Korea deal going is a significant plus.
So South Korea gets peace, stability, and access to cheap North Korean labor. Mitchell Reese is vice provost for international affairs at the College of William and Mary and a former U.S. negotiator in Korea. He says the South is thinking long-term.
They're placing a bet that by engaging in North Korea this way, that over a period of time, and we're talking really decades here, that they will be able to not only raise the level of the standard of living in North Korea, but gradually integrate them into a common economy and more broadly into the region.
But he says some critics say South Korea's generosity could cause more problems than it solves by undermining international efforts to force North Korea to give up its nukes. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Today in Washington, the Senate took to the high seas, actually a treaty called the Law of the Sea. Climate change has forced Congress to take a fresh look at an international agreement it's largely ignored for a decade. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports.
The Senate Foreign Relations Committee held a second round of hearings on a UN treaty called the Law of the Sea. The U.S. is the only Arctic nation that hasn't yet ratified the 10-year-old treaty. Supporters say that means the U.S. doesn't have a seat at the table when it comes to negotiating offshore uses of the sea. And with the Arctic ice cap melting at a record pace, those uses have gained new relevance.
The basic essence is oil.
George Newton is the former head of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission. The U.S. government estimates that the Arctic seabed could hold about a quarter of the world's untapped oil reserves. But Newton says as long as the U.S. refuses to sign the treaty, it's giving other Arctic nations like Russia and Denmark a head start.
What countries want and oil companies want before they begin drilling in the Arctic Ocean is an element of certainty.
Environmental groups also want the treaty signed, but for completely different reasons. They say the Law of the Sea contains strong environmental protections for the world's oceans. And as long as the U.S. remains outside of the treaty, it has no say in how those protections are implemented. But opponents of the treaty say signing on to international laws means you also have to abide by them and can be sued if you don't. David Ridenour is with the National Center for Public Policy Research.
If we are not viewed as complying with some of the environmental standards that are laid out in the Law of the Sea Treaty, environmental activists can actually take it to U.S. domestic courts.
Ridenour says any gains in energy reserves would quickly be swamped by liabilities. The U.S. accounts for the majority of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. He says that makes it the obvious target for lawsuits claiming damages to the ocean ecosystem. I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
In a related vein, that is global warming, the Energy Department has added to speculation we're about to see a boom in nuclear power plants. Energy Secretary Sam Bodman said today the government will guarantee up to 80% of the loans a company needs to get a new nuclear facility up and running. That'll make those loans cheaper, of course. Just last week, NRG Energy out of Princeton, New Jersey, made the first application for a new reactor in this country in 30 years. It didn't take the House long to act after the Blackwater hearing earlier this week. By a vote of 389-30, the lower chamber passed a bill today making all private contractors in combat zones, and not just the ones with guns, subject to the jurisdiction of U.S. courts. You've heard, I'm sure, of the trouble newspapers are having, what with circulation dwindling and ad revenues doing the same thing. Magazine publishers are in the same boat as readers and advertisers desert them for the Internet. Now it seems some big names, like Vogue and Time, might not even make it to the newsstands next week. Our New York Bureau Chief Jill Barchet explains.
More than half of all magazines end up unsold and destroyed. Retailers used to spend millions of dollars keeping track of and returning the unsold copies. Jeremy Greenfield is the editor of Min Online, a trade publication. He says retailers like Walmart have introduced a new scanning system that takes the cost off of their books.
The wholesaler is being asked to keep those magazines on their books as inventory as they're sitting in the shelves in, say, a Walmart.
Half of the nation's retailers are expected to adopt the new scanning system in the next year. Christina Jukadar is managing editor of Circulation Management magazine. She says the nation's largest wholesaler, Anderson News, wants to push the cost back to the manufacturers of the magazines, the publishers.
This fight is really about who's going to pay for the unsold copies.
Publishers like Time, Inc., Condé Nast, and Hearst are threatening to stop shipments next week to Anderson, a big supplier to Walmart and Kroger.
Advertising revenues are declining in print, so this just is one more difficulty that publishers have to deal with. It's really not helping at all.
Experts say they expect the publishers to pay up to keep the magazines on the racks. In New York, I'm Jill Barchet from Marketplace.
Wall Street probably should have just taken today off for all that happened in the markets, which was basically nothing. It's that September jobs report tomorrow that everybody's waiting for. Of course, oil back over $81 a barrel didn't help any. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Bill Gates said today he wants your health records. Microsoft is rolling out a new service it's calling Health Vault, a place online where you can store all your medical records, for free, too. Various organizations have said they're on board, including the American Heart Association and Johnson & Johnson. But what do you suppose is in it for Microsoft? We asked Marketplace's Lisa Napoli to find out.
Right now, only about 20% of all medical records are stored digitally. But Peter Wegman of the Medical Records Institute says companies like Microsoft are preparing now for the day when all those records are electronic.
It might take 10 years until we get there. But people who are creating the infrastructure now are winning.
Wegman says they're winning because there's gold in our personal medical data. Microsoft can offer you a free place to store it and then cash in by selling ads.
Your medical record will be a secure website for every person in the country, and every doctor, every nurse, every pharmacist can directly access it.
So say you're diagnosed as diabetic. Your records are posted online. Then you search online using Microsoft's Health Vault for more information. Companies that make products you might need can market to you directly. Or say you get a new prescription and search online for a place to fill it. Competing pharmacies in your neighborhood can get in touch and offer you a deal. Dr. Stephen Waldron is with the American Association of Family Physicians. He says in order for Microsoft to really cash in, it's got to convince millions of people to use the service.
For these folks to really be successful, they need to get a lot of data on these patients so that they can provide them products and services.
Skeptics say another key to success is going to be convincing patients that services like Health Vault and others proposed by Google are really ironclad and secure. Because if people don't believe their privacy is protected, they'll never sign up. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
If you checked the weather forecast before you got dressed this morning, or used a GPS receiver in your car to help find your way around town, thank the Russians. 50 years ago today, the Soviet Union launched Sputnik and took the early lead in the space race. In a speech at the Russian Academy of Sciences in Moscow today, NASA Administrator Michael Griffin said Sputnik was responsible for the creation of the American space program, too. Commentator and engineer Bill Hammack agrees with him, but he says Sputnik wasn't really about space.
I have a book on my shelf, The Boy Engineer. It's a late 1950s, just post-Sputnik book to entice boys to become engineers. The Boy Engineer wears its era boldly, from the sexism of its title to its technological optimism. The book suggests a boy become an engineer to solve problems of water shortages, traffic congestion, and to find cheaper power, and that the nations of the world are engaged in a fierce and real competition with nations ruled by dictators. We're told that the winners of this contest will be those countries that supply their peoples with the highest standards of living. Not those with the largest nuclear arsenal, but the country with the most household appliances. Now, largely this came true, and America still reigns as the engineering innovator of the world. But in the years since, a certain complacency set in, and now we face a quiet crisis as our science and engineering base, the source of American innovation and our standard of living, slowly erodes. The generation of engineers inspired by Sputnik now enters its emeritus years. With so few to replace them, the average age of an engineer in America rises with each passing day. Today, American students find engineering dull and uncreative, so much so that I recently found myself around a table of fellow 50-something engineers to address the crisis. One of our jobs was to develop a catchphrase that would attract students to the profession. The one that resonated? Engineering, because dreams need doing. The next generation has boldly declared its vision. They dream of a sustainable world. But will they have the engineers to achieve it?
Bill Hammack teaches chemical engineering at the University of Illinois Urbana. If the Sputnik anniversary launched any memories for you, or if you have something else on your mind, let us know. Our website is marketplace.org. When the federal government wants to change something in all the millions of pages of its rules and regulations, it has to give the public a chance to comment, usually for 3 months, 90 days. But this week, the Bureau of Land Management took the unusual step of adding a month to the comment period on a controversial change it wants to make. The White House has plans to dramatically increase the amount of logging allowed on some federal lands in the Pacific Northwest. Environmentalists are crying foul about that, but logging towns are seeing green. Jeremy Hobson reports.
Logging towns in the heart of timber country see this as the dawn of a new day. Ever since the northern spotted owl was placed on the endangered species list in 1990, logging has been drastically cut back. Chris West of the timber industry group, the American Forest Resource Council, says since then, logging companies have been limited to a small slice of federal forest land.
The area is growing 10 billion board feet. We are only harvesting a billion board feet, or 10%.
That limit was set during the Clinton administration, but the industry sued in 1994, saying the government wasn't making all the land it promised available. And when the Bush administration came into office, the industry got a settlement. Environmentalist Steve Pettery says there wasn't much disagreement between administration officials and timber companies.
It was like two foxes discussing how to manage the hen house.
Pettery is conservation director of the group Oregon Wild. He calls the settlement a sweetheart deal for the timber industry that will ramp up logging with little regard for old growth trees or endangered fish and wildlife.
the log industry in Oregon is a lot like the auto industry in Michigan. The auto industry made a lot of bad decisions over the last 20, 30 years and really hurt a lot of people. And what they're trying to do today is repeat those mistakes and hope they get a different outcome.
The Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, is drafting a new forest management plan to implement the terms of the settlement. The BLM's Alan Hoffmeister says the federal government is just trying to follow the law, although he says the government's priorities have changed under the Bush administration.
Do the minimum you have to do to meet the law to avoid causing harm to species listed under the Endangered Species Act.
That's welcome news to the timber industry, and it's welcome news to many Oregon counties, which rely heavily on timber payments for services as basic as local schools and libraries. In Douglas County, residents like Galen Farnsworth see a light at the end of the tunnel.
We live on a street that needs to be widened. They don't have the money to do that with, and they said if they did have the money, they would do it. And there's a few things like that that really would be helped if we had a better economy.
And, says Douglas County Commissioner Marilyn Kittleman, it goes beyond road widening. She says the region has faced huge job losses and everything that follows. She points to a jump in suicides, divorces, and drug addiction since the northern spotted owl was placed on the endangered species list, and logging had to be cut back.
We were a healthy community where people could get out of school with little or no education, go out, work hard, support their family, and have an excellent lifestyle. We can't do that now. What we have now is very few jobs that are available, and the good kids have to leave the area most of the time to go get a job elsewhere.
But environmentalist Steve Pettery says it's time for the counties to find what he calls a sustainable future. He's okay with some logging, but only in areas that have been harvested before.
And we can't just, you know, look at a 400-year-old Douglas fir, you know, a tree that's older than the Constitution, and say that tree's primary value is 2x4s and toilet paper.
Pettery and other environmentalists are making their case to the Bureau of Land Management right now. The BLM is in the midst of a public comment period for the new forest management plan. Environmentalists say they're willing to sue to block the final plan, opening yet another battle in the timber wars. I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Coming up, trash problems pile high and wide in Hong Kong.
The harbor now is beginning to pretty well close up. It's turned from a big harbor into mostly a river.
But first, let's do the numbers. The street kept its head above water today ahead of tomorrow's key jobs report. The Dow Industrials ticked up 6 points. That's less than a tenth of 1% to end at 13,974. The Nasdaq padded up 4 points, one-tenth of 1% to end at 2733. The S&P 500 advanced 3 points, two-tenths of 1% to close at 1542. Pharmaceutical stocks were a bright spot. Merck put on 1.33%. Pfizer named a new research chief to head clinical development of its new drugs. That lifted the world's biggest drug maker 0.8%. After the bell, Research in Motion reported its profits. Sales almost doubled in the second quarter. The maker of the BlackBerry gained nearly 4.5% on that prospect before the bell. And then, somehow, go figure the way the markets work, lost about 3% in after-hours trading. Bond prices rose, pushed the yield on the 10-year T-note down to 4.52%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Duke University's Fuqua School of Business Executive MBA programs, where working professionals earn Duke MBAs from locations around the world. Online at DukeExecutiveMBA.com. By Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals at Vanguard.com. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. Want to hear something on Marketplace again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and additional special features, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just head over to marketplace.org.
Yeah.
Here's a glance at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Friday. The Labor Department releases unemployment numbers for September. The Federal Reserve Board reports on consumer credit for August. And the first televised presidential speech was broadcast on October 5, 1947. President Truman asked citizens to conserve food so more could be sent to Europe as it recovered from World War II. But in 1947, most of the nation still got their news from radio. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The National Hockey League season began in earnest last night. If you're anything less than an avid hockey fan, though, you might have missed it. We're barely a week into October. Baseball's just getting interesting, and the NFL season is heating up. All of which go to make Diana Nyad's point about the position hockey's put itself in. Hey, Diana.
Kai, what's going on?
Well, here's what's really going on for me. The Yankees play tonight, so honestly, I'm not too interested in hockey.
Well, you know, count yourself among millions. I mean, why does hockey start in September?
Yeah.
Excuse me. I'm not a big hockey fan, but I could appreciate it as a winter sport.
That being the case, though, you have to give them credit for trying. I mean, they're doing some new things this year to recover from the strike, right?
Yeah, they're doing new things. They're going to have a fantastic outdoor game with maybe 75,000 people just outside Buffalo, on January 1st, which that's fun. I'd go if I were close by and had a really big parka. You know, I think what we're really talking about with hockey, to my mind, it's sort of like a denial. Hockey was part of the Big Four in the 50s, 60s, 70s, even up through the 1980s. Superstars, Wayne Gretzky, but it's not anymore. NASCAR and the X Games and even the World Series of Poker outdraws hockey on television.
What's the disconnect then?
The disconnect is the money. The corporate money and the beautiful ice rinks are here in North America, but the huge, rabid, let's not count Canada for a second, the huge rabid fan base is Sweden. It's Finland. It's Slovakia, Russia. And to my mind, we should combine the two, be the first truly international league, the NHL. It would be exciting. It'd be maverick.
Now, the NHL did have a season opener in London 4, 5, 6 days ago, right?
First time ever. The Kings and the Ducks played in London, and England isn't even the hockey
country, of
Europe. But it was close enough by that all those Finns and Swedes and Czechs came in. They all wore their jerseys. It was a raucous, exciting two-game set. And, you know, why not take the Anaheim Ducks? Why don't they have a rink and a training center and even a competition center in, let's say, Zurich in Switzerland? And once a year, they go over there and they settle down for about 3 weeks and they play all the teams in Europe. Then they come back here. And then why doesn't the team in Zurich come over here, play all the teams in the U.S.? The world is small these days.
All right. Well, let's talk about the Diana Nyad World Hockey League here for a second. And the thing you have to make money in professional sports these days, a television contract.
Yeah. And look at the one they got now.
Well, right.
Look at the one they got now. It used to be the Outdoor Life Network is now called Versus. And, you know, I mentioned the World Series of Poker before, but Kai, during the strike, the 2004-2005 season, when hockey was out that entire season, poker, you know, people would rather sit and watch a guy stare at a pair of nines then tune in to the greatest hockey players in the world. That's got to tell the commissioner something. And one thing it's got to tell him is that if he could get that television contract in Sweden and in Russia, where people would stay up till 2, 3, 4 in the morning, it's the number one sport in a lot of these countries. Number one, you wouldn't even have competition. If he could share in that television revenue, all that merchandising, you know, all those gate receipts, all of a sudden the fan base and the money would be huge. I'd go watch Sweden against the Anaheim Ducks, wouldn't you?
I probably would. Diana Nyad and the Business of Sports Hockey this time. Thanks, Diana.
Thanks, Kai.
The Chinese government has taken a page from the Department of Homeland Security. Beijing is planning its own color-coded alert system, not for security, mind you, for lousy products, mainly food. The range goes from a not-so-bad blue up through yellow, orange, and red. It's debatable, though, whether consumers will need help protecting their palates. The Asian economic miracle has created a generation of picky eaters there. And in fact, in Hong Kong, wasted food is a big problem. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports now a few restaurants are taking aim at leftovers.
This qualifies as a good lunch deal. $5 at the Ming General Restaurant buys all the sushi you can eat. Take all you want, but as they say, eat all you take or else. Each piece you leave on your plate here earns you a fine of $1.25. Restaurant spokesperson Tracy Furness spoke by phone about the owners and their new policy.
They saw it in Japan. They thought it was a good idea to bring over to Hong Kong. And they just thought this would be a great idea to make people think about what they're wasting.
A recent poll found the average Hong Konger tosses out a third of each restaurant serving. Food waste has doubled here in the last 5 years, as the economic boom means more folks can eat out. And increasingly, all this trash has nowhere to go in overcrowded Hong Kong.
In terms of landfill space, we're running out.
Michael DeGallier of Hong Kong Baptist University estimates the landfills will be full in 5 years. And already, policymakers are getting creative with the city's rubbish. They dump some of it in the historic harbor, then build high-rises on top.
The harbor now is beginning to pretty well close up. It's turned from a big harbor into mostly a river, about that same width across most of it.
So if trash disposal is a problem for Hong Kong, then cracking down on wasted food would seem a solution. But fining restaurant goers who don't clean their plates? That's a bit too confrontational for industry consultant Louis Chan. He says it turns off the customers.
You get angry to the customer, you know, and they'll never come back. And they'll complain to their friends, to media, to some government, you know. You're not losing one customer. You may be losing 100 customers.
In fact, many businessmen take their clients out to restaurants and then order a ton of food on purpose.
On a small table, they order like 10 to 15 dishes. And then the dish after the dish, you know, from people of Shanghai, they feel it's a respect to the client. So this is their culture.
But the Ming General Sushi joint isn't backing down from its war on leftovers. In fact, even if a customer tries something adventurous, like sea slug or eel, and doesn't like it, too bad. Spokesman Tracy Furness.
They've got a fine, and they know next time not to order it. That has happened. But if you're with somebody who's really good and kind, maybe they'll eat it for you.
Another solution? Play the ignorant foreigner, oh, I didn't know routine. That'll get you off, too. In Hong Kong, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Consumer Consequences, American Public Media's online game, exploring what the world would be like if everyone on Earth consumed like you. Online at consumerconsequences.org. And by Putnam Investments, where a mix of large U.S. companies can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note before you go today, Daimler Chrysler is no longer after the German and American carmakers split this summer. One might have thought their collective name would separate automatically, but one would be wrong. Today, Daimler chief Dieter Zetsche put a name change vote before shareholders. 99% of them approved the new name, Daimler AG. That tiny fraction of dissent came in part from the great-great-grandniece of Carl Benz. Benz is the guy who patented a three-wheeled internal combustion automobile back in 1886. He also co-founded the company that used to be called Daimler-Benz AG. And we are called Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 6 points, less than a fraction. The Nasdaq added 4 points, 0.1%. The S&P 500 jumped up 3 points, 0.2%. Our editors include Kevin Arnovitz, Patty Hirsch, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker. Coming up next time on the program, why one form of liquid currency is so popular.
Because there's this some notion of, I like beer, you like beer, everyone likes beer, let's have some beer.
What could possibly go wrong? I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.